for all sorts of reasons, you know. Murder, you name it, we had them down there.
What happened after that?
I was then posted down the road to HMS Terror, and I had my own, although I was, HMS Terror was the main shore establishment, my patrol headquarters was in the dockyard, and we had a wonderful man called Lieutenant Commander Mahaffey, who was the Naval Provost Marshal, and I was a Master in Arms, and my job was to patrol Singapore, to deal with all the drugs situation, to deal with the anti-vice squad, I had an anti-vice squad, and I had a team of four RPOs and 12 leading patrolmen, leading regulators.
Ernie Smith, Real Six. So in effect, you were doing a similar sort of job to the job you were doing in Portland.
Yes.
But in slightly different...
Quite different, because we were responsible there for... I reported to the Naval Provost Marshal, and I also had a direct line to the Commander-in-Chief in the Far East, because at the time the Vietnam War was going on, and we were having a lot of American sailors coming over for R&R. Now, all sorts of weird things were happening at the time that even now the general public wouldn't even know about, but there was... In addition to the Vietnam War and all the Viet Cong that was going on, the Viet Cong had developed a strain of syphilis which could kill in about 2 months. It was an absolutely virulent, toxic thing. And they infected these Vietnamese girls and sent them over to Singapore. They were working as prostitutes. And they were working in areas where they knew that American soldiers were going for R&R. And so these kids would become infected and end up in a Japanese hospital 2 months later dying, and their parents would be told that they had died in action, you know, killed in action. And I was sent for and said, how do we deal with this? How do we clean this up? And so the Americans came up with a brilliant idea of taking over a hotel, it's unbelievable, this, staffing it with prostitutes that had all been medically examined, jamming it with as many drugs as that the kids wanted, and booze, and the kids would come over from Vietnam, and they would go in there for a week, they weren't allowed out, they could have anything they wanted within the food, drugs, girls, and then back to the front line again. And that was actually administered by the Americans. Yeah. Now, my job was different because my job under the Defence of the Realm Act was to deal with sailors, soldiers and airmen who went ashore. And we were there in a way to make sure they didn't get themselves into serious problems. There was 600,000 prostitutes in Singapore, 60,000 brothels, and we had a real, real big venereal disease problem, which we had a very sophisticated way of dealing with, because if a soldier or a sailor was infected, they would be sent to my headquarters, and we had books and books. And we could isolate from the bar that they went to, and that bar was serviced by a particular taxi, and when the taxi would be servicing particular brothels, and then we had pictures of all the girls in the brothels, and we could actually isolate the girl that infected them, and it was such a sophisticated system. And then we would go ashore, my team would go ashore, and say to the girl that you're infected, take her off the streets, and then she would go and get herself cleaned up, and if they didn't do it, if the the women in charge, mamas, didn't do it, they would find the police going along there burning the place down. So they'll, you know, they dealt with it. That's the way we dealt with the problem of highly infectious venereal disease in the Far East, and it worked.
Slightly different from with your crusader in Portland. you mentioned drugs as well. Was there a problem with drugs amongst the sailors?
Big problem with drugs.
Tell me about that.
Well, it was the beginning a lot of it was opium out there, and there was opium houses, you know. And you'd go into this room, very dark, and there'd be like futons on the floor, little tatami mats, and with ceramic pillows. And they would have the opium pipes, and the old lady would go around there, and she would prick the opium in the pipe and light it and give it to whoever was lying down there, and he'd go into an opium dream, opium haze. So that was a lot of it, and the sailors actually used to go to these opium dens. And of course we would go down there, we would look round, if we see a white person we knew that he was either a serviceman of some sort or other, or a white civilian dockyard worker. And then on top of that, of course, there was a lot of heroin around and marijuana, but mostly heroin was the problem, and opium.
What action did you take against the people running these places, or indeed dealing in drugs?
We couldn't take any action against them running it, because the police out there were totally corrupt, and they were paying the police for the privilege of operating. In fact, if we were going to go out and do a raid on particular massage parlours or brothels over in Johor Bahru, which was the Malaysian side of it, or the Singapore side of it, particular areas, Janang Kayu or whatever, and we'd have three or four trucks armed, my guys armed on board, and sometimes we'd have police with us. I would never allow them to open the envelope until they got into their trucks as to where we were going to raid that night, because the police would immediately get on to the brothels and tell them that we were raiding them, because they were corrupt, totally corrupt.
What action did you take against any sailors or servicemen that you found taking drugs?
They were court-martialed and they were sent home. That was, The drug aspect of it, we were able to keep on top. It was the prostitution was something that was very difficult. I remember a very, very senior member of parliament coming out to visit us, and they always used to want to go around and look at all the brothels and all the bits and pieces of whatever. And this very, very senior man, who's actually only recently retired from parliament, started off tutting all over the place. And of course, we used to gee the girls up. We used to say to them when they come in, you know, make sure that you sit on their laps and ruffle their hair and give them a beer, etc. And they said, totally embarrassed them, you know.
Who was this?
I'm not saying. And anyway, I remember him saying to me, "Master Army, you know, how do you see your role out here?" And I said to him, "Well, sir, all the time a sailor has got one between his legs, he'll use it. My job is to make sure that he points in the right direction." Anyway, this guy went and said at the end of the end of the evening, he said to me, "I think you're doing a tremendous job. Keep it up," and off he went. But it was very difficult, because we were dealing with secret society. We were dealing with triads. It was just awful, you know. The village that we operated from, which was outside of the dockyard, was called Sembawang. Now, that was the village where all the sailors used to use all the bars, and all the bar girls were there. It was absolutely, it was like, was like the Wild West, actually, in the old days of the Wild West. And my guys would patrol ashore, and they would either patrol in uniform, or I had plain clothes guys ashore, intelligent guys as well. And whenever we had other nations visiting, like the naval, New Zealanders or Australian Navy, there was always going to be a problem of fights ashore, so we had to deal with that situation, you know. But there was also all the triads were operating in these villages, and they, all the girls, were paying tribute to them, and the bar owners were paying tribute to them. In other words, part of their money was going over them. And whenever there was a big punch up in a bar, or a gut bar was smashed out, the bar owner would say to me, "Oh, Master Arms, all this damage has been done. $1,000, where I'll get my money from?" And I say to him, "You get your money from the secret societies. You pay them, you let them look after you. When you clear them out of your place, then I will allow you to get recompense from the Navy." And the secret societies, the head of the secret societies, even sat down, wanted to talk to me about how we divvy up this Sem Wang. Because he thought, I don't know, they thought that we were there making money out of it. They couldn't understand why we would be doing this, you know, on a discipline sort of thing. Very strange, very very dangerous place at the time. I remember. Very exciting, though.
So your jurisdiction was over all service personnel?
Yeah, yeah.
Regardless of what?
Rank.
Branch.
Yeah, rank, but regardless of rank or anything else.
Can I ask you to compare that experience with your time on the Belfast? Because obviously you had sailors going ashore at Singapore and places like that. Was there that sort of trouble with the Belfast company?
Yes, there was. You know, people would go ashore off the Belfast and get drunk and land up in the hands of the local gendarmerie. But one of the lessons I learned on the Belfast, which I carried with me when I was a Master Arms of the Naval Patrol, was that if ever we picked up a sailor that was drunk in the streets of Singapore or been thrown out of a bar or something, my instructions to my regulating petty officers were to pick him up, to put him in their vehicle, and to take him back to his ship, and to get him back on board, and to put him in the care of the duty RPO or the officer of the watch on board. And that was that was the priority as far as I was concerned. I never ever wanted to see a sailor in a strange foreign land without somebody taking care of him, because, you know, he could have been robbed, he could have been mugged, all sorts of things would have happened to him. And that was, I always said, never mind about the charging. The charging isn't important. Prioritising is getting the man back to his ship, back to his family. And that's one thing I learned from the Belfast, which I thought was an important lesson.
So you were in Singapore for about 2 years?
Yes, 2 years and 3 months.
And did you return to England after that?
I did, yes. I came back with my wife and my son. He was now about 14, 15. He had a thoroughly good time out there. He loved it. We came back, and then there was 2 years left for me in the service, and I ended up as the officer commanding joint services and troop movements at Luton Airport. And that was quite an interesting job as well. A little, small contingent of myself, a petty officer, two flight sergeants, a sergeant in the army, a couple of corporals in the Air Force, and a couple of corporals in the Army. About 12 of us, since I was in charge of this unit. And we operated from RAF Hendon was my commanding officer, but we actually had an office in Luton Airport, and we operated from there. And our job was we were running daily flights out to Germany, to Hanover, Berlin, Dusseldorf, and that was run by contract by Britannia Airways. and while Britannia Airways would ticket the soldiers going across, we would be actually responsible for getting them on the aircraft and the discipline of seating them down and dealing with all aspects of the flight as a troop movements. Very interesting job.
So these were civilian flights?
Yes, yeah, carrier flights. They were contracted out to the service.
What happened after that?
After that, I went into barracks to be discharged from the Royal Navy. And that was, I have to say, was the biggest downer, the worst day of my naval career. It was terrible. I was there for 48 hours, and I wandered around with a bit of paper, thoroughly depressed. Going around to different departments, getting my card stamped by the sick bay, by the dentist, and then went to the stores and somebody said, "Where's your hammock?" And I said, "Don't be foolish, hammocks went out." And they, "Well, you were issued with a hammock when you were in that." And "Where's this and that and the other, you know, and where's the green case and all this?" And I said, "Go away, go away." And then I had to go and see the duty officer officer of the day, who was a Malaysian Lieutenant Commander with very limited command of the English language. And he said, "Master Arms, you go from Master to Mister. Ha ha ha, thank you for your service." Shook my hand and I walked out the main gate with my case in my hand, and I thought, well, that's it.
Where was that?
That was 1970, November 1970.
So you've been in the Navy for 27 years. And was there any... Did the Navy make any preparations for your return to civilian life?
Well, they did. I was sent to what they call a rehabilitation course. And this was going to go on for 6 weeks. And it was somewhere strange, like Coolsden or Purley. And I went there, and there was this guy there in a brown overall, and he was talking about the jobs that we might all do. There was about 10 of us in the class, and he was talking about being a charge hand at Lucas Battery, or going down on the line at Ford's, and because I had been a master at arms, there was a good possibility of me ending up as a foreman or a supervisory. And I listened to all this crap for about 4 days, and I was really getting incensed with this lot. And I took the Times paper in one day and I sat down, then I rolled it up and I started making a Christmas tree out of it, and it was getting higher and higher and higher because everybody fell apart. And he said to me, "You're being disruptive." And I said, "Yes, I am." I said, I understand, I am." I said, I don't think that I can learn anything from you any more than you can learn anything from me, so I think we'll call it a day." So I left there, and I thought, what a terrible, you know, way to be dealt with after all the years in the service. You know, they didn't know how to deal with, really, servicemen on retirement. They had no idea, no rehabilitation thoughts in their head at all. And so I left there, and I thought, well, the only one person that's going to get Ernie Smith a job, and that's Ernie Smith.
Anything else that was done for you before you left?
Nothing at all. Nothing at all.
And was it just because your time in the Navy had
expired? Yeah.
You left.
Yes.
Yeah. How did you adjust to civilian life?
Well, with great difficulty, really. I was the sort of a person that when I. Because in the service, you have what they call 2-year tranches or 3-year tranches. You do 2-year commission or 2.5-year commission, and then you completely change direction and you're doing something else. You're going from a ship to a shore establishment to Luton Airport to thief taking in Singapore. Completely different 2-year parts or 2.5-year parts. And so this, to me, was the next job I was going to do was something different for the next 2.5 years, although it wasn't going to be 2.5 years, it was going to be longer than that. And I thought, well, what am I good at? And I thought, well, security, I guess, is which I am good at, because I'm just in the police force, really. And I saw this advert in the paper for Mecca, and they were looking for a security officer. And I thought, well, that'll do me fine. So I went along to the interview with Eric Morley, who was then chairman of the company, the Southwark Street. And I sat in his office, and his secretary said, oh, can I get you a cup of tea? And I said, no, I'm fine, thank you. She said, you might like to read this magazine. And she gave me the In-House magazine. And I was looking through this lot, and there was all these branches. There was Hammersmith Paddy and Cafe de Paris and the Lyceum and the Streatham Cat's Whiskers and all the dancing girls and all the bands and all the acts. And I thought, I believe this is going on. You know, this is part of this company. And I thought, well, I wouldn't mind a bit of this. So I went in there to see Eric Morley. He said, oh, Mr. Smith, he said, you've come for the security job. And I said, no, I've come for manager's job. He said, well, I've got you down as a security. I said, no, not interested in security, I'm a manager. He said, but you're 40 years of age. He said, we take managers on 20, 21, trainees. And I said, well, you know, I'm 40. I said, call me an executive trainee. And I said, pay me what you would an ordinary trainee. And if you like what I do in 3 months, then fine, we'll talk about it. If not, I'll get on my bike. He said, all right, then we'll try that, which we did. And then I took to it like a duck to water. In fact, the first day at Mecca, I didn't know what to expect. I was told to go down to the Orchid Ballroom in Purley and report to the manager at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And I went there in a pinstripe suit and a briefcase. I had no idea what to expect. And the manager came in and he was drunk. I've had a lifetime experiences with drunks, you know. And this guy was like 35, 5 years younger than me. And he saw me coming in as a threat. He didn't know why I was suddenly pushed on him. He didn't want an executive trainee manager or anything else. He had an assistant manager anyway who was in Kahoo. He's drinking Oppo. So he said, right. He said, well, what do you know about this business? I said, well, absolutely nothing. He said, well, what am I supposed to do with you? So we had this conversation. So he said, right. He said, you know you're going to have to do all sorts of jobs. I said, whatever comes. So he said, he whispered something to the assistant manager, and the assistant manager came out with one of these very large, long brooms. He said, well, why don't you go and sweep the ballroom floor? And there was me with my briefcase and my coat, and I thought, oh, I'm not having this, I'm going home, you know, telling the stuff their job. But I thought, no, hold on a minute. So I took my coat off, folded up very carefully, put the briefcase down, got the broom and went round and swept the floor up, then told to take the chains off. That night I was clipping tickets on the door, and that was the worst part. My chin had really sunk right low. But the good part is that 3 months later, I was given the assistant manager of the ballroom in the Empire Leicester Square, and 6 months after that I was a general manager of Tiffany's, one of their major branches. And a year later, I was the managing director of the North of England. And a year later, I was managing director of Mecca.
I think you had other interests in the entertainment business.
In what way, sorry?
You did other things in the entertainment business.
Yes, I did, because when I finished with the nightclub part of the business, I was in London, and I was at the Lyceum Ballroom, and I was asked to go down to the Hammersmith Paddy as they were putting on the World Ballroom Dance Championships, and the guy who was in charge of it, the producer, was drunk. He'd fallen over drunk, and they wanted me to go down there and just to help out while this was going on. And I went down there, and there he was, laying on the floor out of it. So we kicked him in the office, took over, and I organised the thing. And I thought, oh, this is a piece of cake. It was really good fun, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And then after that, I was asked by Morley if I wanted to do more television work, and I said, yes, I would. And then I started in that side of the business. And then Morley was sacked from Mecca. And then I was asked to take over the job that he was doing in terms of the Mecca promotions, etc. And then from there, the job really transpired into me working for Variety Club of Great Britain, and I did a number of their major shows, and I'm really pleased to say that I've worked and produced most of the major stars in the country today. Yeah.
Do you think your time in the Navy has helped or hindered your subsequent career?
Helped.
In what way?
Organisation. The organisation that I learnt through the routines of the service. I mean, putting together, I was looking at some of, knowing you were coming down today, I was just looking through some of my old scripts that I'd put together for shows. And it was there, it was like a serial, timings, dates, you know, sections, and it was all the basics that I'd ever learnt in the Navy. A very funny thing though, I told you earlier on that Lord Mountbatten, I'd been on his staff in the 50s. Now also, when I was in Singapore as a Master at Arms in 1968, he was making a television series called The Life and Times of Lord Mountbatten. And when I was asked as a Master at Arms out there to act as his security, and I went round with him for a few days. And that wasn't itself without incident. But anyway, that went off all right. And the next time I met him, I was putting on a show for the Variety Club of Great Britain. And it was a £150,000 production. And we had Shirley Bassey as one of the artists. We had Joe Longthorne. We had Michael Crawford. Really, really top stars. And we were having dinner that night. And this was the show after. It was an award ceremony. And before dinner, Mountbatten, who was the guest of honour, we had a reception cocktail party for him. And I said to the Chief Barker, incidentally, I said, I'd work on the staff of Lord Mountbatten, so when you come round and introduce yourself, remind him. So he said, yeah, okay, fine. So he came round with Lord Mountbatten, and when Lord Mountbatten said, before he said, oh, this is Ernie Smith, he said, I know you. And I said, yes, sir. He said, remind me. And I said, 1960 in 68 in Singapore, and then I was on your staff in 50. Yes, he said. And Chief Parker said, Ernie is our producer. He's producing the show. This is his show. And he turned around to me and said, I always said that a sailor knew about Sod's opera. And here we are, there's £150,000 show with top stars had been reduced to a naval knees up by Lord Mountbatten.
That's a nice way to round things off, really. Thank you very much.